History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Every few years, C-SPAN surveys historians and asks them to rank U.S. presidents from the absolute best to the absolute worst on a number of criteria. This includes public persuasion, crisis management, international relations, moral authority, administrative skills, and pursuing equal justice for all. You can probably guess who's at the top of the list. These are mostly the people on Mount Rushmore. But for many years, there was a three-way competition for the absolute worst president. And this bottom spot switch between James Buchanan, who did nothing to stop the Civil War, Andrew Johnson, a very racist president who let Reconstruction fail, and Warren G. Harding. Warren G. Harding was a president in the 1920s who's popularly assumed to not really care about doing anything. He was an empty suit who was more concerned with golf, poker, and his mistress than doing anything as president. He let the laissez-faire capitalism in the 1920s metastasize into the Great Depression, and he appointed cronies who plundered the U.S. government in a variety of creative ways, and allowed oil men to bribe him and his friends in order to tap into government oil reserves, including one in Teapot Dome, Wyoming, of which the Teapot Dome scandal was named. But my guest today argues that this impression is completely wrong. Harding doesn't belong in the bottom tier of U.S. presidents. In fact, he may very well belong in the top 10. The only reason he's so maligned is due to the halo effect of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who's overcredited with the policies of the New Deal, rescuing America from the Great Depression, and the very real moral failings of Warren G. Harding that clouded his legacy afterwards, and lastly, that he died in office, so those around him who were corrupt could conveniently blame him for everything that happened. Today's guest is Ryan S. Walters, author of the book The Jazz Age President, defending Warren G. Harding. He argues that Harding succeeded because, first of all, he inherited a post-war depression. There was the little-known depression of 1920, and Harding turned it into an economic boom. On his watch, prosperity soared, and unemployment fell to 1.6%, and the national debt was slashed. He reversed Woodrow Wilson's plans to hand over much of America's sovereignty to foreign organizations, and he also healed the nation in the throes of social disruption. He released citizens imprisoned by the Wilson administration under the Sedition Act of 1918, and he also used the bully pulpit to promote civil rights in the heyday of Jim Crow. In this time period, America experienced some of the worst domestic terrorism in history, from the Ku Klux Klan and the lynchings in the South to anarchist attacks and bombings. Harding did such things as speak in the heart of Dixie in Birmingham, Alabama, and call for the full legal rights and protections and voting rights for African-American citizens. And he openly condemned the massacre in Tulsa, Oklahoma in 1921. Harding says that far from being America's worst president, Harding should be remembered as the most underestimated and unfairly maligned president in American history. Now, whether or not you agree with him and you're not a strong advocate of Harding one way or another, this episode is a good way to consider how historical narratives take root and how reputations take hold, fair or unfair. And overall, it's an examination of how historical narratives are formed. Hope you enjoy this discussion with Ryan Walters. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be back.
Well, Warren G. Harding has appeared on this podcast a number of times, mostly because listeners perceive him to be America's worst president, and that makes him curious. And to enter into him, I want to mention one of the first detailed accounts I read about him. This actually came from a book by the pop psychologist Malcolm Gladwell in his book Blink, about how short little glances at something can trigger a lot of information in us, but sometimes it can give us the wrong information. And Warren G. Harding was an example of this, where he appeared presidential, but even though he had the appearance and trapping of it, he wasn't. And his story is that an Ohio lawyer and lobbyist named Harry Daugherty was a newspaper editor, and when he saw Harding in a hotel, he sized him up and asked himself, wouldn't Harding make a great president just by first impressions? And by Gladwell's account, Harding wasn't especially intelligent, and he had more of a reputation as a poker player and womanizer than an effective politician. Also, so his rise was caused by his wife, by the scheming of Harry Daugherty. And when he spoke at the Republican National Convention in 1916, he was sort of the lowest common denominator, or in 1920, he was the lowest common denominator, and that's what caused his rise in politics. So that was my impression coming in. I don't know what your impression was of Harding before you started, but what led you to want to do a revisionist account of his presidency?
Well, again, thanks for having me, and this is a really important topic. Of course, as a historian, I mean, as a political historian, I study American politics. I'm going to study all these various presidents. I didn't know that much about Harding when I was in college and really started grad school, but I picked up tidbits in columns by Pat Buchanan and different people that Harding was actually not a bad president. And I actually got the idea in grad school to do a book on Harding, as far back as that's been. When I started this book, I was digging around in my notes. I found the original notes that I had from grad school when I kind of sketched the book out the way I wanted to do it. And of course, that was about 20 years ago, but it's finally come to fruition. And I don't necessarily like the term revisionist, only because it's almost become akin to something like conspiracy theorist or something. There's nothing really wrong with the word, because he does need revising. I mean, he's been trashed for nearly a century. And a lot of them are political tacks that his enemies used against him. But when you dig into the record, you find something quite different. He actually was not a bad president at all. Actually, I think he was a pretty good president. He's just been maligned so much and hammered so much to admire Wilson and FDR. So, of course, they hate him. And these attacks have just become gospel over the decades. And there have been a few attempts to right the wrongs, but I'm hoping this is maybe we can start to make some real progress. I think there has been some progress. He's finished last on more worst presidents lists than any other president. But in the last few years, he's bumped up a notch. Now, I don't mean a lot. He's come up two or three rungs, but he's still in the failure category, but he shouldn't be.
Who's overtaken him? The Andrew Johnsons and James Buchanans?
Yeah, Johnson, Buchanan's down there. Yeah, Buchanan is the other one that's generally the worst president ever. There's been a book in recent years on Buchanan. So it's really a competition between Harding and Buchanan. Yeah, throw Andrew Johnson down there. Franklin Pierce will be down there pretty low as well. But Harding's usually in the bottom three or four in every rank, and I've never seen him higher than that. In a standard academic historical survey, I'm talking about. Now, if you look at survey by a more conservative or libertarian historian, he's gonna rise much higher, but just the standard academic historians, yeah, he's down at the bottom. But most of them are very, very strong conservative, Coolidge as well. They are tarnished and maligned.
Well, I suppose we should understand the narrative first before we see the problems with it. Harding is America's worst president. How did this narrative take hold? What were the facts that were used to assemble this argument?
Well, you got to understand, Harding came in incredibly popular. He set the record for the most popular votes. He got more than 60% of the popular vote in 1920, and he was very popular during his presidency. Of course, he died in office. He died on August the 2nd, 1923, and he was on the West Coast. They had to bring his body back across to the White House. You know, throngs of people came out to the, as a railroad went by. A lot of people said it was the greatest outpouring of people since Lincoln's assassination. So he was a very beloved president by the people themselves. But of course, he's got a few scandals in his administration, and a lot of those scandals started to break after he died of what was going on. So that was really where it started. Of course, he had people at the time he was president. You always have enemies that are trashing you. But when the scandal started, that's when people began to take a negative view of him. And of course, again, they just don't like his policies anyway. So that just added fuel to the fire. So over time, he's seen as one of the worst presidents because of the scandals. But of course, in the book, I deal with the scandals. And he handled the scandals much differently. And there were only three. And he handled them much differently than other presidents like Grant or Bill Clinton handled.
Why do you think the scandals stuck to his reputation? For example, one of them was the relations with his mistress, which became public. Now, there are many presidents, of course, that had mistresses. This seemed to tarnish Harding in a way that didn't other presidents. And the other is the Teapot Dome scandal, which we can get into later. Why did these particular scandals hurt him in a way that didn't with other people?
Yeah, the mistresses is a scandal. And I really don't consider it a scandal in relation to corruption. Harding did have a couple of extramarital affairs during his lifetime, but never when he was president. Of course, he had a wife that he was married to for a long time, Florence. And I don't know what kind of relationship they had. They didn't have any children, but they had seemed to have more of a partnership than a real marriage. Of course, Harding was a newspaper owner, and Florence helped him out a lot with that. She seemed to have a really good business mind. And again, Harding had a couple of extramarital affairs, but again, they've trashed his reputation by trying to say that he did that while he was in the Oval Office, when he was president of the United States. And that's simply not true. He had of course, the most well-known was Nan Britton, which we now know produced a child. And Nan Britton wrote a book in 1927, 4 years after Harding's death, called President's Daughter. And she made all these accusations against Harding. And she's one of the ones that said, yeah, I used to sneak into the White House and we used to go in a closet off the Oval Office and, you know, do our thing. And I think a lot of what was in the book was trash, but she did say that that was Harding's child. And we now know through DNA that it was. But that happened years before he was president. I used three solid primary sources from people who worked inside the White House, including the head Secret Service agent, who said no women came to the White House to see President Harding. It's these things that just take on a life of their own, and people just, and again, they're political attacks. They just start smearing people by saying, yeah, I heard he has a different woman every night and that kind of thing. That's just not true. Again, the Secret Service agent said, no, nobody ever came in this White House. The doorman, everybody that would have to come through the White House would have to pass through the White House doorman and sign in. He said, nobody came in here. Never heard of Nan Britton. Never heard of any of these women. So you can, the sources are out there. The record's out there. You just have to look at it and not look at some of these political attacks that have been carried on for decades.
I want to get into his record on a number of factors. Let's first look at his economic record. He and other presidents after him, Coolidge and others as well, Hoover, are blamed for essentially causing the Great Depression because of the lack of regulation in financial markets, which allows the stock market to spiral out of control. And many of the laws that regulate finance are done precisely in the wake of this period in the 1920s. That's at least I'm describing the understanding of this period. So what do you think was successful about his economic policies and what wasn't? And how fair do you think this is that he and others created the chaotic conditions that triggered the Great Depression?
Well, his economic record is pretty stellar. You have to, one thing about Harding, and I do this in the book, you have to really understand the condition the country was in before he became president. And I start out with the fight over the League of Nations, and then, of course, the awful events of 1919. And of course, in January 1920, the economy goes into a depression. It's called the Forgotten Depression in American history because people really don't realize we had one in 1920. It lasted about a year and a half. It's usually not listed in America's depressions, but it had the potential to be pretty severe coming out of World War I. The unemployment rate was about 4% in 1919. It shot up 12%. Industrial production fell, all of the normal indicators that caused a pretty severe depression. So he is elected in the midst of this depression. And of course, he comes in with a laissez-faire capitalistic solution for the woes of the economy. He's the last president, he and Coolidge are the last presidents to deal with a depression, a recession with laissez-faire economics. From Hoover on, and I don't count Hoover in with Harding and Coolidge. It's typical for academic historians to say, well, Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover, like they're on the same team. Hoover was a progressive Republican. He was not a conservative. Matter of fact, when Harding named him to the cabinet in 1921, Secretary of Commerce, a lot of conservatives in the Senate that had to confirm Hoover did not like it at all and did not want him there because he was too much of a progressive. And of course, he became president in 1929, Hoover began to reverse Harding and Coolidge policies. It was Hoover that raised income taxes. It was Hoover that had the Smoot-Hawley tariff and the Reconstruction Finance Corporation and the spending. As a matter of fact, when FDR ran against Hoover in 1932, he criticized Hoover for spending too much, if you can believe that, not balancing the budget. So Harding's program and Coolidge as well is far different than Hoover. Harding's program, because you got to remember income taxes under Wilson during World War One had gone up to more than 70% on the top rate. Spending was sky high. Before World War One, the federal budget was a little more than $700 million with an M. It got up to almost $20 billion with war spending. By the time Harding came in, it was still about $6 billion. He slashed spending down to about $3 billion. Taxes under Harding and Coolidge went from 77% on the top rate down to 25% over those 8 years. So you get a very robust economy during the 1920s. That's why it's called the Roaring Twenties. Again, as you mentioned, there's unfettered capitalism. There's unregulated capitalism. I mean, people are there's not a lot of restrictions at all on the economy. But we've never had economic growth like we did in the 1920s. We've never had as low an unemployment rate. In 1926, the unemployment rate statistic was 1.6%. Now, understand something about that. This is before welfare. This is before any type of government assistance. There's a lot of people that get government assistance today, and they're not counted as unemployed in the statistics. This is before that. So when you say you got a 1.6 unemployment rate, that's a true 1.6 unemployment rate. It's phenomenal. It was really another industrial revolution for the country in terms of industrial production. It's a record that's never been rivaled. If you give them credit for the boom of the 1920s, you have to give them credit for the bust of the 1930s. No, you don't. No, you don't at all. I mean, we had a market correction in 1929 and probably no more than a recession. But when Hoover came in and began to engineer things, raising taxes and that kind of thing, and tariffs and other things, and then FDR right behind him with the New Deal. And don't forget, a lot of it had to do with Federal Reserve policy. A lot of the Great Depression came from the Federal Reserve. They've even admitted that. When the Federal Reserve takes a third of the money out of circulation in a four-year period, and then the government confiscates a good percentage of the rest, it shouldn't be a shock that the economy couldn't grow during the 1930s. And we were in a Great Depression. I mean, how can you have robust economic growth when you're taking a third of the money out of circulation and the government's tripling taxes and quadrupling spending? I mean, it shouldn't be a shock to anybody.
I'd like to talk about his foreign policy. In the 1920 presidential election, he ran on the return to normalcy against Wilson, against the League of Nations, against the 14 points, against this internationalist vision of restructuring the world order after World War One. What do you think was a success here? And then were there any failures, do you think, with his foreign policy?
His foreign policy was actually very good. Most people don't realize that Harding was nominated twice for the Nobel Peace Prize. And remember, he served less time than John F. Kennedy did, less than 900 days because he died in 1923. And his accomplishments in foreign policy are pretty incredible. Because when he comes in, of course, you've got the League of Nations fight. That was the big fight in 1919 and 1920 politically, Woodrow Wilson's League of Nations, which the Senate stopped. And Harding was instrumental in helping to do that. He was a member of the Foreign Relations Committee. He went to the White House with Henry Cabot Lodge and others to talk to Wilson about the League proposal. Lodge allowed Harding to have the opening speech on the Senate floor opposing the League of Nations. He gave a great speech. It won him a lot of praise. And of course, as you know, the League of Nations was voted down twice in 1919 and in early 1920. United States never ratified the Treaty of Versailles. We never joined the League of Nations. And of course, Woodrow Wilson, who wanted a third term, he wanted the nomination in 1920, didn't get it. James Cox, also from Ohio, the governor of Ohio. So it was kind of an interesting election. You had the governor of Ohio versus the U.S. Senator Harding from Ohio. And they were both newspaper men. They were both newspaper owners. They were both journalists, which was kind of interesting. But Wilson wanted to make the League the number one issue in that campaign. And it was. And Harding was not for the League. And of course, Cox's running mate was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. They had to run on the League proposal. And they were trounced. I mean, the people gave Harding more than 60% of the vote. So that pretty much killed the League issue. And Harding was adamant as president, we're not going to join the League of Nations. Forget it. But he had other accomplishments as well. He formally ended World War One. He withdrew troops from Germany from the Rhineland area. He withdrew troops from the Caribbean. Woodrow Wilson had done a lot to destroy U.S. prestige throughout the Caribbean, Mexico, and other areas. And Harding worked very hard in his 2.5 years in office to restore our credibility. He reached out to Mexico and other nations. Again, he withdrew troops from down there. But probably his biggest foreign policy triumph is the Washington Naval Conference, or also known as the Washington Disarmament Conference. This is the first arms reduction conference the United States was ever involved in. And it was to do with naval power. And he called the conference, and it met in Washington. And of course, the feared weapons of the day, the big weapons of those days, are not air power, certainly not nuclear weapons yet, but it was naval weaponry. And at least one of the causes of World War I was a naval race, a naval buildup between Germany and Britain. And Harding and his Secretary of State, Charles Evans Hughes, wanted to, and there were some senators that were for this as well, wanted to call this conference and see about reducing the world's worst weapons. And that's what happened. There was a reduction in naval weaponry with all the great powers of the world. There was also some treaties I talk about in the book that were struck, specifically in the Pacific region. And one diplomatic historian said that the result of Harding's conference was gaining peace in the Pacific for about a decade. Now, of course, it unraveled with Japan in the early 30s, but we basically had a peaceful era in the Pacific for about a decade. So it was very, very successful, the conference. And again, he was nominated twice for the Nobel Peace Prize because of his efforts. So his foreign policy was actually very, very good. He had an activist foreign policy, and he was pretty, he was not the dummy that people try to say he was, at least in terms of foreign policy.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Another part of his legacy, which I think really is overlooked, is his efforts on civil rights, speeches he gave in the South, commemorating the massacre at Tulsa, Oklahoma, and even, I think this is interesting, the long rumor that he's one of possibly America's first Black president, which has taken on an interesting life of its own. So could you speak to that record?
Yeah, that gets lost in the shuffle. A lot of people don't know about it at all, because civil rights, I mean, after Reconstruction, the federal government makes almost zero effort on civil rights. The last civil rights bill we had was in 1875. Of course, Reconstruction was over in 1877. Federal government does next to nothing on civil rights, certainly not with Woodrow Wilson. There had been a few little things that had happened. Of course, Theodore Roosevelt inviting Booker T. Washington to the White House. And of course, the South came unglued about that when that happened. And of course, when you get to Woodrow Wilson was a notorious racist and white supremacist. There had been some efforts to put African-American people in jobs in federal government to desegregate the city. Woodrow Wilson comes in and sweeps all of that away. Washington, D.C. is resegregated. Wilson even tried to get a bill passed. I think it passed the House. It failed in the Senate to make racial mixing a felony in Washington, D.C. So he has that reputation. So Harding comes in. Of course, in 1919, before he comes into office, it's known as the Red Summer. The racial violence of 1919, and I detail it in the book, was just awful. Lynchings in different parts of the country, a lot of violence against Black people. And Harding comes in as a Lincoln Republican, if you will, in that regard. He calls for federal anti-lynching legislation. Of course, you have the awful Tulsa Massacre in 1921 that he spoke out against and said needs to be investigated. He spoke at an all-Black college. Probably the biggest thing he did. Now, you think about this. This is the height of segregation in the South, and he went to the South, not just the South, but the Deep South, to Birmingham, Alabama, the heart of Dixie, the heart of the old Confederacy, and gave a speech. Of course, it was a segregated audience, but and said that Black people should be accorded their equality in the Union, that they should be treated, we should get rid of segregation, or they should be treated equally. That is very courageous to do. No other president had done anything like that at all. Of course, later FDR comes in, and FDR has a deplorable record on civil rights. FDR would have never done anything like that. And remember, Harding had splintered the solid South a little bit. I mean, the South had voted Democrat solidly in every election since 1880, but 1920 Tennessee voted for Harding, shockingly. So he did cut into it a little bit. It was pretty courageous for him to do that. And again, he called for civil rights legislation, anti-lynching legislation, couldn't get it passed. But his record is good because he at least he was out there using the bully pulpit of the presidency itself to work on behalf of equality of both races.
A dean at a school, I believe in Ohio, made a claim that he was, in his words, octoroon of 1/8 Black ancestry. This would be a way to besmirch him in the public and try to hurt his public profile. But as far as I'm aware, this led to the rumor, the longstanding rumor, that he was one of America's first Black president, at least of partial ancestry. Do I have that story correct?
That was the allegation, but that's not correct. DNA is proven otherwise. But here's the thing about Harding that makes him different than a typical white president or politician, that, particularly at that time period. He had a little bit more sympathy and empathy and understanding with Black people, because the rumor was, even when he was a kid, that he had Black ancestry. And of course, those days, it didn't matter if it was North or South, the country was felt the same way. He was called the N-word when he was a little kid. His father-in-law did not like him, Florence's father. He actually called him that too, even when he was an adult. So he was sensitive to that kind of thing. So he had some empathy and understood better than other white people what it meant to be in a position like that. So I think that's why his civil rights record's a lot better than other presidents of that time period. I think he had some empathy. And of course, it was just his personality. Warren Harding was a really nice, warm, caring man, a very generous man. He was not bad at all. I mean, he did a lot of things for poor people in Marion, Ohio, because he made a very good living as the owner of the Marion Star newspaper. And a lot of people had a lot of affection for him. He always told people, call me Warren. Even when he was president, he said, my name is Warren. Call me Warren. You don't have to call me Mr. Harding. Even his employees at the newspaper said, he said, call me Warren. Even when he played golf with his friends while he was president, he'd say, look, I'm just Warren Harding, and we're out here playing golf. I mean, he was that type of just a laid back guy, not arrogant in the least, and very kind and generous, and particularly with animals. He loved animals. Didn't like people who were abusive of animals. He'd even call them out in his newspaper. So his reputation, again, it's been tarnished in that regard as well.
The scandal that his administration is known for is the Teapot Dome scandal, in which oilmen for a modest under-the-table sum could tap into government oil reserves. And this includes the Teapot Dome oil reserve in Wyoming, after which this is named. After Harding dies, it's convenient for his advisors to blame him. Since then, his Secretary of the Interior has been seen as one of the ringleaders. But I mention all this to ask, I'm curious about legitimate criticisms of Harding. If there's anything that his administration is known for, it's the Teapot Dome scandal, in which oilmen, if they paid an under-the-table sum or bribe, they could tap into government oil reserves, including one in Teapot Dome, Wyoming, after which this is named. Now, after Harding died, his advisors blamed him for the scandal. It's convenient to blame someone who's dead and can't answer back.
Yeah.
But more recently, his Secretary of the Interior was blamed for this, of plundering the government in a variety of ways. So even if Harding can't be directly implicated, perhaps you could say that he had a poor eye for hiring his staff. And then others have said things that he was too busy with poker and affairs to really run a competent administration. Whether or not that's all true, based on what you've researched, what do you think are fair criticisms of him and his administration? Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
Yeah, obviously, presidents are responsible for who they choose. Now, you can't keep up with all of them. People are going to go off and do things, and that certainly happened. Daugherty, as you mentioned, the attorney general, was probably not the best pick for that particular department, the Department of Justice. Of course, he had a right-hand man named Jesse Smith there, and there was all kind of corruption in the Justice Department. They nicknamed it at the time the Department of Easy Virtue. I mean, you could, because this is a time during Prohibition, you could bribe somebody, and you could bribe Jesse Smith and get a, you know, a liquor license or whatever, a pardon or whatever you needed out of the Justice Department. So that was probably not a very good pick, even though, of course, Jesse Smith ended up committing suicide. Harding actually confronted him on that and told him that he was going to be arrested for what he had done. And the man went home, burned all of his personal papers, and committed suicide. There was actually another suicide in the Veterans Bureau scandal with Charles Forbes, the Bureau's attorney, committed suicide over that one. There's about $2 million lifted in that scandal. And of course, Teapot Dome, Albert Fall was a U.S. Senator. Harding knew him in the Senate, chose him for Interior. And of course, Fall was, you know, engaged in that. He's the one that got the oil fields moved to the Interior Department. He's the one that took the bribes to lease them to two oil men. So he's certainly responsible. And Harding chose him. That's correct. But you have to remember, Albert Fall was confirmed by the Senate unanimously. So a lot of people say, well, Harding should have known he was a bad guy. Well, that means that everybody in the Senate should have known he was a bad guy, too. And I will say this about Harding. Again, you have to fault him a little bit for saying, oh, for picking these guys, because Harding trusted people. That was really a fault. He trusted people. He was a kind man. And he just couldn't believe that his friends would do something like that. He even told a reporter one time, and I'll clean the language up, but he said, I don't have trouble with my enemies. It's my friends. It's my blank friends that keep me up walking the floors at night. So he's guilty, I guess, of being a little bit too trusting, not being skeptical enough. But as far as Teapot Dome, again, that was the worst of it. It's hard to fault Harding totally because he died about the time he found out about what was going on. Again, he had confronted Jesse Smith with the Justice Department scandal, and then he was on his westward tour in 1923. He was going out to the West Coast, went up to Alaska, came down the West Coast, and that's where he died. He had found out what was going on. He actually talked to Herbert Hoover. Hoover talked about in his memoirs where the Harding sat down with him and said, look, we got a bad scandal coming. Should I publish this thing or what should I do? You know, should I just not say anything? And Hoover said, no, we got to put it out there. And I think what Harding was doing there was, he'd already confronted Jesse Smith, who committed suicide. I think that was kind of on his mind. Do I go, you know, what do I do now? Somebody else going to shoot themselves. We've already had two over these scandals. And I think that's probably what he would have done when he got back from the West Coast tour. We don't know. We do know it was on his mind. And I think that's what makes Harding different than other scandalous administrations, particularly Grant. Look at what Grant did. Grant had many more scandals than Harding did. And Grant didn't do anything about any of them. And in most cases, he defended people who were implicated in wrongdoing. Harding confronted Charles Forbes over the Veterans Bureau. A New York Times reporter walked in, and Harding had Forbes by the throat, shaking him, he said, like a dog would a rat. Said he was he double-crossed him. You know, he was going after these people for doing this. Grant didn't do that at all. And, of course, other presidents don't really do that either. You know, Clinton didn't, and others. So, yeah, I think there's certainly some criticism there, but I think you have to understand, too, that Harding was doing something about the scandals. He wasn't trying to cover them up, and he wasn't trying to let them go either.
I'm curious, in light of this discussion, where would you place Harding on the list of presidents? You don't have to have an exact ranking, but approximately where would you put him? The third quartile, second quartile? What are your reasonings for where you would place him? And what do you think it says from your view that he is vastly underrated as a president based on how we view historical figures? So where would you place him on the list? And what do you think it says about our understanding of history when we've misunderstood somebody like him so much?
Well, I said in the book, I mean, obviously Harding's not going to be on Mount Rushmore. I mean, we're not going to go carve him on Mount Rushmore. And that's obviously because of the scandals and things. And most people probably won't ever consider him a great president, but I think you have to at least consider him a good president. I mean, when you come in, when you look at what he took on when he came in, coming out of 20 years of progressivism, World War I and the aftermath of that, the fight of the League of Nations, the awful events of 1919, not only the racial violence, but we had a lot of domestic terrorism going on in the country, Bolsheviks and anarchists and all, bombings and things like that, an economy that hit the Depression, and he came in and righted the ship. it came in and got the economy back growing again, and it led to the most prosperous decade in American history. Again, working out problems in foreign policy, not only civil rights, but there were other things. I mean, there were a lot of people that Woodrow Wilson had thrown in prison because they opposed his war. Eugene Debs, who was the country's leading socialist, didn't agree with Harding at all. But you know what Harding did? Harding commuted his sentence, let him out of prison. And all Debs had done was give a speech to oppose Wilson's war. There were people that were thrown in jail for making speeches. Harding led a number of these. In other words, he emptied the nation's jails of political prisoners. I mean, he was a national healer, which is what I call him in the book. So I would certainly rank him in my top 10, no question about that. And there are others that will as well. Robert Spencer had a recent book on presidential rankings and ranked Harding number 9. Others have ranked him higher as well. I mean, when you think about what he accomplished, what else do you want a president to do? I mean, seriously, well, I mean, yeah, he was the model president. He didn't come in with some vision that we're going to radically change the country and we're going to have a new deal and that kind of thing. He said, no, this is not what a president is supposed to do. He runs the executive branch, and he did exactly what a president should do. He's not trying to change the country. He did exactly what he said he was going to do, which is return to normalcy, coming out of progressivism and that kind of thing. And so the only thing people get in their history classes in college, not mine, but and most people get is Harding was a terrible president. That's the only thing they know. And most books and things, it's just sort of a given that Harding's the worst president or one of the worst. And most people don't know a thing in the world about him. They just heard that from a history professor or read it in somebody's book. So there's very few efforts out there to try to correct the record, and hopefully we can make some progress here.
Okay, well, I have visited Harding's legacy many times in this show, so it's a good chance to fully flesh out his legacy and understand what was happening in the 1920s and bring a lot more context to it. So, Ryan, thank you for joining us in discussing this. And for listeners who want to look at your book and explore this in much more detail, the name of it is The Jazz Age President, Defending Warren G. Harding. Ryan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, that is all for today. If you'd like to see show notes for this episode and all my other episodes, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network that this show is a part of, along with other great history shows like Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and other shows as well. If you'd like to support this show, there are two easy ways to do so. The first is to subscribe to History Unplugged on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second thing is to join the show's membership program. It's on Patreon, and if you go to patreon.com/unplugged and join it, as a member, you'll get completely ad-free episodes of the show's entire back catalog, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.